Welcome to Hyperlocal, the podcast inspiring economic developers, job creators, and community champions with local solutions and global perspectives. I'm your host, Mason Ainsworth. Thank you for taking the time to join us today, and let's get into it. Joining me today is Brock Dickinson, a true visionary in the field of economic development and entrepreneurship. Brock is currently vice chair of the board of directors at Invest Ontario, a partner at Stonebridge Solutions, and a director of the Economic Development Program, where I took the year one and year two at the University of Waterloo, and is also the executive in residence at Innovate Niagara. Brock's expertise in economic development is unmatched, with a career spanning financing for large-scale projects, clean tech, international trade, and technology-based economic development. He's worked in over 30 countries around the world, delivering keynote speeches across Canada, and is passionate about making the world a better place through problem solving and knowledge sharing, which he's going to be doing with us today. In this dynamic episode, we're going to be diving into a once-in-a-generation opportunity to reshape local economies, speaking about one of my personal favorite items, the British Railway Trap, and its lessons for today's modern development. We're going to be talking about navigating global trade, demographic shifts, supply chain challenges, the United States, and the role of rural communities in a rapidly changing world. There's going to be some insights into artificial intelligence, the United Nations, and effective local decision making. We have a banger of an episode today, and I hope that you enjoy it. Now let's get into it. Brock, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. I really appreciate it. And I know we've got a lot of good questions for you and excited to continue our discussion. I know we chatted a little bit earlier just about a few different things and how things are going to roll out. But I'm excited to get started. But do you have anything to say before we get rolling?
Oh, I just want to say thanks for having me on the podcast, Mason. I'm really looking forward to this.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure and really excited to get into some questions today. I know one thing when I'm at conferences or at different events with the chamber and such, and I meet wonderful people such as yourself who are up on stage speaking on so many different occasions. And I always wonder, you know, where did these people come from? How did they become so awesome? And what is their kind of their origin story? You know, not to call you a superhero, but I think you are in economic development. And I know you've worked in different cities, with universities, with entrepreneurs across the world. And, you know, from Waterloo to the United Nations, you've pretty much done it all. So I'm just curious, what inspired you to pursue economic development and how did your journey lead you throughout the years since you started? And maybe if you could tell us a little bit about your new venture with Stonebridge Solutions as well.
Perfect. Yeah, I'll try to kind of run through the whole history, but I always sort of reflect on the fact that I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up and I'm starting to run out of time. So it's been a bit of a checkered journey. I always think that, you know, no kid ever grows up saying, I want to be an economic developer when I'm older. And so I think everybody kind of comes to this field almost accidentally or you know, by happenstance. There's a lot of chance that drives us into this space. And when I was sort of coming through university and sort of thinking about what I wanted to do for a career, I really wanted to be a diplomat. I wanted to work in international relations and sort of, you know, sort of bring together governments around different projects and different initiatives. And development was definitely a focus of that for me. I was really concerned about, you know, poverty in developing countries or the way that we build an international system that is just and fair and that sort of thing. So when I left university, I went off and joined the United Nations. And I actually spent 6 years working in about 30 different countries. It was amazing. But the moment that drove me to economic development still sort of stands out in my mind. I was doing some work in the Philippines and sort of making recommendations there to the government about different things they could or should be doing. And one of the senators that I was working with, a fellow named Jefferson Alvarez, he actually passed away during the COVID-19 pandemic. He came to me after one of the meetings and he said, I understand what you're asking us to do, right? And pass this legislation, develop this program, you know, add this to your educational initiatives. He says, but why should I do that? How do I know that this is going to work? And I kind of realized that all of my answers were, well, you know, I read it in a textbook once that that's what you're supposed to do, or New York told me that you were supposed to do that, or the theory says, that I had no kind of practical, hands-on, real-world experience of my own in terms of what works or what doesn't work when it comes to development in communities or development at the local level. And so I left the UN shortly after that, went back to my home region in Nova Scotia to take over the Economic Development Agency there. And it was an area and a time with real challenges, lots of things that were not going well in the local economy. And I figured, I can't just preach this stuff to other people. I got to learn what works and what doesn't work and whether or not economic development makes a difference. And that's what really kind of opened my eye is to the opportunities to do amazing things at the local level. And having done that for a few years in rural Nova Scotia, I looked for an opportunity to kind of move into a more urban setting. I came to Southern Ontario to the city of St. Catharines. I later moved into a provincial agency for a while, working in investment attraction. And then a few years ago, launched a consulting firm, which eventually became known as MDB Insight, was later acquired by Deloitte. And that firm started small, but grew to become the largest economic development consulting firm in Canada with projects all around the world. And so I sort of had this opportunity to kind of take that knowledge that I had then learned at the local level and take it back out to the broader world. Now, I sold that firm a few years ago, and that's what opened up the opportunity to kind of move to the University of Waterloo to sort of say, hey, I've done this in an urban context, a rural context, a provincial context, an international context. What else can I do in this space? And that led me to the academic realm and being able to kind of work with young people and students exploring entrepreneurship and economic development issues. I guess the latest stop in the journey, as you mentioned, though, is this new startup that I launched 6 months ago with a couple of partners called Stonebridge Solutions. And it really sort of reflects that last big piece of the economic development world that I haven't worked in, which is in the financing space. That as we think about scaling up companies in our communities, we think about building out new manufacturing facilities or business parks or residential development projects. As we think about kind of attracting large scale investments, there's a financial component to a lot of those projects. And that's something that I hadn't previously had the opportunity to work in. And so Stonebridge, which I operate with four other partners, is really a company that provides financing to large scale economic development projects. So 25 million US or larger, we work with a series of what are known as family offices across the United States to unlock financing for large scale projects that will benefit communities. And so, 6 months old, but among the things that I've been working on, I've got a couple of really interesting new biotech startups that are working in the cancer treatment space, doing some real estate development projects in places like Texas and Ontario. Looking at some manufacturing operations in a number of locations across North America. And so this kind of window into how we finance and how we actually arrange the money to make economic development projects work at that large scale has been a really interesting opportunity as well.
That's incredible, Brock. And I just wanted to go back to what I said earlier. I do think you are a superhero because you are doing it all. And even just the small fact that you're in 30 different countries is amazing. Most people don't even travel to more than a couple during their lifetime. So I think that's an amazing experience and your journey through. I like when you said happenstance. I think that's something I'm a big believer myself that everything happens for a reason. And, as you mentioned, when you ask kids what they want to do when they're older, usually majority of them, I don't think end up doing what they would say back then. I know I sure didn't. And so that evolving adventure through life and when different things happen and how it leads you in different directions and the people that you meet, I think is something really special and something I think in economic development as well that that relationships are so important to developing the future. And holy mackerel, just the stuff you talked about there and very impressive. And I'm really excited that the new project is going well for you. And I'm sure you folks are going to make a really large impact in a whole bunch of different communities.
I appreciate
Speaking
that.
of.
Yeah, I like the happenstance notion as well. It always reminds me of sometimes it's attributed to Thomas Jefferson, sometimes to Mark Twain or others, but this notion that I've been really lucky over my lifetime and over my career. And the harder I work, the luckier I get. And I think that that's part of it too, that you put the effort into things, you never know where they're going to lead, but there's always some interesting door that opens up.
I love it. I love it. That is great, and I'm so glad you have that perspective. And I think that's something that I know you've shared with me in the past through Waterloo, and I know you're making a big impact through there and really helping shape the next generation of innovators and economic developers. And I'm just curious if you can share a little bit about your experience with Waterloo and teaching students like myself, and you know if you've heard from any of them, if they're championing different economic development projects across Canada, if there's any that have stood out for you, or anything that they've just said, "Hey, Brock, like thanks so much for teaching me about this. Now we're actually implementing some of these things."
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, working in the educational space is so different than other things. There's a colleague of mine, a professor at the University of North Carolina named Tom Morris. He's actually a philosopher, and he sort of suggests that our life is kind of divided into three components. And he says, for the first 25 years of our life, we're learning, right? We're coming to grips with the world around us and how it works. And then for the next 25 years of our life, we're building. We're actually sort of out there creating things and developing things and working hard. And he says, in the next 25 years after that is really when we should be mentoring and teaching. And I think I'm not done building yet, but I do like the notion that that mentoring and teaching is something that we're all kind of called to do, obligated to do, in a sense. You think of the role of elders in First Nations communities, for example, the sense that once you've built a body of knowledge, it's important to kind of share that. So that's part of what led me to the university. But the other side of it is that I, like you and like many other economic developers across Canada, I started out as a young economic developer going into the program at the University of Waterloo, this professional training program, hoping for my ECDE certification through EDAC. And I loved the learning opportunity, right? Like I got to meet so many of my peers and colleagues from across the country. These became people that I could call on when I had a question or a challenge or a problem. I still talk to some of my classmates from that year one program that I did back in the 90s. And I guess as I sort of graduated from the program and started to think about, how I could contribute to the industry, that program just kept drawing me back that, if mentoring and teaching was to be something important, that was the best way to do it. And I think I struggled a little coming into the field in the 90s, a little bit of the old boys network not being happy to see these young guns coming in with new ideas about how the economy works or what communities should be doing. And I guess I've sort of seen my attachment to the university as a way to both try to break that glass ceiling of the old boys club to make sure that young people coming into the field do get the opportunities that they deserve and get the support that they need as they kind of work to change the way we think about economic development. But also this chance to kind of be there. Yeah, we're doing some teaching and we're doing some training, but to be there as young professionals coming into the field develop these national networks and national sort of sets of colleagues that can support them through their entire careers. I think I get more than that or as much of that out of being a part of the program as the students do, right? So it's this really exciting way to kind of say or to see what's coming next in the economic development field and who that next generation of leaders are and kind of learning important ways or beneficial ways to support the efforts that they're undertaking. It's been something that's been hugely rewarding for me as somebody later in their career.
That's incredible. And I did not realize before today that you actually went through the year one program. I think that's incredible. You went from, as you mentioned, just getting involved at the start and meeting folks to now speaking on stages at EDCO and different conferences across the country. I think that's amazing. And it really shows folks who are listening, especially if there's new folks who are interested in, a career in economic development, that, hey, it's, you can start off and you can do incredible things like you're doing. So I know that's really inspiring to me, and I'm sure to other folks listening as well.
I appreciate it. I always say inspiration's a two-way street, and there's no question that the benefits that I get out of being of that program in my mind far outweigh the things that I'm offering to others. So I'm extremely grateful to be a part of
Well, you're also very humble, so
it.
I know I've learned a lot from you, and hopefully I've passed over some little small portion, and even through today I'm sure we're gonna have a good conversation. Just jumping back a little bit, Brock, I know you already talked about the United Nations and being in over 30 countries in the past. I know you've got a lot of good global perspectives as a result of that. And you've worked in, worked with different international partners. You've spoken at lots of different workshops, a few through EDCO that I've attended myself, and recently done some talks about Trump and tariffs. I'm curious if you could give us a little snapshot on, what you think's going on out there, and then how folks who are listening would better adapt to what's going on today, and if there's any, in your travels, best practices that would help with some of these local solutions that we need now more than ever.
Yeah, that's interesting. I really feel like we're at this crossroads of history, and maybe every generation feels like they're in that space, and that the world is changing quickly. But I think that one of the things that's unique to our time is that we're not always aware of the changes that are happening. And I've been sort of going out and traveling, around the country across North America for the last 4 or 5 years to talk about the changes that I see happening. And some of this, it's kind of macroeconomic, geopolitical stuff that's shifting that, seems like it's a million miles away. And so it's not that relevant to what we're doing. But the way that it plays out has really local implications. And so I think about big trends like, demographic shifts. We're seeing places like China or Germany or Italy sort of poised for a bit of a demographic collapse. The population is likely to shrink dramatically over the course of the next couple of decades. We're seeing declines in global trade. So, we talk about globalization all the time, but in fact, global trade levels have been declining since 2008. I think about the challenges that we have around supply chains and this sort of global trade system that we built up that's kind of fraying around the edges. The water levels are too low in the canals, or we have piracy that interferes with our supply chains, or there's wars breaking out everywhere, which makes it difficult to fly over certain regions. And suddenly everything gets sort of constrained and challenged. And I think part of what happened is in that context is that even kind of smaller issues loom larger than they might otherwise when we have those big forces at work in the background. And so I see, the arrival of President Trump with the Trump 2 administration in January as this thing that kind of triggered our awareness of our vulnerability to all of these global structures and systems that were kind of, in a little bit of decline and fraying around the edges. And so I think part of what Trump has done is to exacerbate or accelerate some of these pre-existing challenges. And so suddenly we're kind of confronted with the reality of these larger processes that have been at play and trying to figure out what this means for our communities. We're at the tail end of very long supply chains that threaten the stability of our companies. We're part of a global trading system that isn't as reliant on global trade as it was in the past. And therefore, as a nation of exporters, how does that kind of impact our opportunities? So a lot of what I like to look at now as I'm traveling and speaking with folks is the implications of this for individual communities or companies or industries. All of this big stuff is happening half a world away, but all of it has impacts in our own backyards. And so what are those impacts? And some of those are negative. And we're sort of seeing with the Trump tariffs, for example, the pretty severe impact that that's had on the automotive sector in Southern Ontario, for example. Real challenges for real companies and real communities. At the same time, not all of this change is going to be bad for us, right? There are lots of emerging opportunities as well. And so part of what I like to focus on is this sense that in the midst of this change, there's a rewriting of the rules of how the international economy works. And there are ways that we can benefit from that as well. And so, I talk about sort of 20 key sectors of the Canadian economy that I think are poised for absolutely massive growth over the next decade or two. And that's things like mining and minerals, it's energy, it's defense and aerospace, it's sort of drone technologies and AI, and this whole sort of range of things that we kind of talk about a little bit in the background, but we've really not put front and center in our economic development thinking. And I see us at this kind of interesting political moment as provincial leaders, premiers, territorial leaders are starting to think about new ways of approaching these issues as the new prime minister is kind of trying to kind of refocus our attention on some of these sorts of issues. And as First Nations leaders are kind of rethinking the way in which they can kind of lead economic development opportunities in the country, that we've got this kind of coming together of forces that's really kind of creating a once in a generation sort of opportunity to take our communities in very new, very positive directions. That won't come without growing pains. That won't come out without some suffering in some circles as the economy changes. But I really do think that Canada is in a really interesting and very positive spot to take advantage of a lot of what's happening if we play the right cards over the next couple of years.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I know through my work with the Ontario Chamber, hearing from so many businesses, and obviously there is a lot of stress out there. There's a lot of folks who have been impacted. I don't want to say that there's not, but also, as you mentioned, I think it is that once in a generation opportunity, and you're seeing now, and even I think it's today or recently that the premiers are all getting together in Ontario to talk about, ways to get rid of the interprovincial trade barriers, and they've already done a lot to reduce those. And these things have been talked about for years. And I think that this was kind of the match that made that happen. I don't think if it, if Donald Trump didn't get reelected and these discussions didn't happen, I'm not sure if we would have come together as much as a country so quickly. So I do think there's good opportunities to take advantage of what is going on right now and make sure folks unify, work together, and develop the future that we want.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that we're in the midst of a summer where we're worried about the potential for recession in the Canadian economy. In the last quarter, the economy reportedly contracted by 0.1%. That's pretty much standing still, but it is a negative number. But you mentioned something like, the removal or reduction of interprovincial trade barriers, and even the most conservative estimates that I've seen in terms of the economic impact of that on the Canadian economy. The most conservative suggestion was that that could grow the Canadian economy by 7% if we got rid of those barriers. There's estimates that the introduction of artificial intelligence could grow the Canadian economy by another 7%. And so, when we start to look at some of these changes and trends and what they could mean for growth of the economy, suddenly a 0.1 reduction doesn't look so threatening or so worrying in the context of what could come next and where we could be going if we get our ducks lined up.
Absolutely. I'm very excited for the future. I know during your answer, you talked a little bit about AI and you mentioned that a bit and how it's gonna has this potential to be such a massive impact in the future. And I know when we're at EDCO, I presented on AI, artificial intelligence and amplified individuals, the future of economic development in the public sector. And so it's not hard to draw a line that I'm super interested in AI. And so hoping that Hyperlocal can explore that in the future a bit with folks. And I'm just curious, are you seeing AI in economic development right now? Are you seeing any tools? Are you hearing things from folks? Do you think it's a good opportunity for communities to grow or municipalities to enhance services? Or what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I would probably answer that question in two ways. And one is that, we're in the time of generative AI, and the large language models and this sort of thing. And so I think when we talk about AI at the moment, we're doing two things in the economic development space. One is we're thinking about new tools. And I would say those tools are emerging, but they're not that great yet. But we can kind of see where they may be in the future. So if I'm doing business retention and expansion activities in my community, having an AI-driven tool could really help me in that situation, because BR&E is really, in some ways, a data challenge, right? I've got to meet with a bunch of companies, I've got to interview them, I've got to identify data around them, and then I've got to predict what's going to happen to them in the future. Are they going to grow? Are they going to shrink? And how do I sort of change that trajectory? Or when I think about foreign direct investment and investment attraction, right? How many companies are there in the world that are getting ready to expand? When is that expansion likely to take place? What markets are they going to expand into? What communities within those markets will they locate their manufacturing facilities in? That sort of thing. That's a big data question. And so AI offers the opportunity to kind of develop some really interesting supports for the economic development practice that we can kind of take these big data questions and find better ways to do them. I think at the moment we've got lots of people promising that their tools can do that, but we really haven't got great tools in that space yet. But within the next 5 years or so, I think we can see the potential for some of those sorts of things. The other area that we're currently talking about a lot in ECDev and AI is around workforce. And what does this mean in terms of the displacement of the workforce? And I'm part of the camp that does have some concerns on that front, that I do worry about white-collar jobs in particular being displaced in the shift to AI, and that's something we've got to come to terms with and talk about more creatively than we have so far. But leaving those aside for the moment, the real issue that I see in the AI space is one that we haven't begun to talk about that much yet, and that's the kind of the way in which AI begins to transform the broader economy. And so I think of AI not as this kind of tool or a set of widgets that I can use in my day-to-day work, but as this force that transforms the way that industry works. So we could compare it to historical transitions like the introduction of electricity into manufacturing. So when you think about, when we moved from steam power to electricity as the basis of our manufacturing sector, that kind of changed the rules of everything in the manufacturing space. And for example, the way that we built buildings in the age of steam was different than the way we built them in the age of electricity. So a factory in the Victorian age had to be very tall and have these massive flywheels and piping systems because the further the steam got from the boiler that created it, the less force that it had. And so the physical structure of manufacturing buildings was based around this notion that you need to kind of accommodate something that maximizes the force of steam power. When we got to electricity, you could string an electric line for miles and it doesn't really lose its power as it sort of runs along there. And so manufacturing shifted. We think of the kind of the typical assembly line in an automotive plant as this long, flat, low sort of line that can run, a couple of thousand meters from end to end. And it's a very different configuration than what we saw in the Victorian age with steam power. And I think that AI kind of transforms just about every aspect of the way that business and industry function in the same way that electricity did. And so one of the things it will do is to kind of transform the physical nature of what we build in our industrial parks and in our, industrial zones and this sort of thing. If you look at some of the emerging AI-powered buildings that are popping up, they don't have a lot of human employees. They don't have a lot of high ceilings or empty spaces. You can just kind of compact a large operation into a very small footprint. There's a plant that I have visited a few times in Moncton, New Brunswick. It's operated by PPG, the big international coatings company based out of Pittsburgh. It's a paint factory, essentially, industrial coatings. And it's like a 72,000 square foot facility with six employees, right? And there's this sense that we've got this physical structure that has been created in a way that does not look like buildings of the past. There are no hallways, there are no corridors, there are no shop floors. This is essentially a giant machine inside a box. And so just physically looks very different than what we've seen in industrial spaces over the course of the last 100 years. So this suggests a few things to me in terms of AI's impact on economic development. One is that, traditionally when we did economic development, if we went after a big manufacturing company to try to get them to come to our community, we won in a number of different ways. We got jobs for the community because, a manufacturing company had jobs attached to it. And we got tax revenues for the municipality or for the province because, the new tenant in that space, the new operation occupying that land would pay taxes. We're finding in the age of AI that those two things, taxes and employment, are separate from each other. They don't necessarily go hand in hand. So here we've got this huge new facility in Moncton. It's great from a tax perspective, pays lots of tax revenues to the city and to the province, but it's not so good from an employment perspective, right? You get six jobs at the opening of that kind of a plant. That's not wonderful when it comes to job creation. And so the things that we have historically taken as things that go hand in hand in economic development are suddenly bifurcating. They're splitting in a sense, and we need to kind of have active discussions about what is the objective of economic development in the age of AI. Do we prioritize those tax revenues, or do we prioritize the economic benefits of something like job creation in our community? And there's not necessarily a right or wrong answer to that question, but we're being forced to ask it that way for the first time. And that this kind of emergence of AI in industry kind of forces us to rethink what economic development is and how it operates. The fact that the physical structure of the buildings is changing also causes us to rethink a whole series of things. You know, what kind of setbacks do we require? What are the parking requirements on a building with no employees? A lot of our communities have maximum height guidelines within their planning regulations and this sort of thing. So suddenly, if I can build an AI-driven facility on a very small footprint of land, but I can build a high building, that's going to be very attractive for an investor who's trying to build that kind of a facility, but it might not be permitted by the kind of municipal bylaws and regulations that we see at the local level. And so we've got this kind of whole series of emerging questions driven by AI as it comes into the economic development space that we really just haven't started to think about that much yet. And I think that that's going to be critical over the coming months and years.
I find that fascinating, and even the question about parking for a building that has no employees. A lot of municipalities, as we know, have, hey, if you have X amount of square feet, you have to have this many spaces, and so that is definitely a question. And then the height restrictions in a lot of places, it gets me thinking about something. And I believe it was in year one at Waterloo that you talked about, and it was the British railway trap. And the idea of that, and that's just pounding in my mind. I was wondering, because you do it so much justice, if you could just give us a quick rundown of the British railway trap and what that means, and especially in the context of thinking about things today.
Yeah, it's a bit of an apocryphal story, and lots of debate online. You can check it out, but it's the sense that when we think about the modern railroad system that we have in Canada, it's an interesting kind of system because it was deliberately created. You know, in other places like the States, it was the railroad barons and those who kind of built the system, but in Canada, we set about building a national railroad as a kind of a nation-building exercise, the same kind of thing we're talking about in today's political climate. And there was this sense that we wanted to link the colonies of British North America from coast to coast. And so committees and groups were struck to kind of plan this out. It was a pre-planned exercise. And of course, one of the first decisions those committees would have had to make is what is the gauge of the railroads going to be in this new Canadian system? And the gauge is essentially the space between the two tracks, which sounds like something that would be pretty easy to figure out, but somebody has to actually make that decision. And the gauge that was settled on by those early planners in the colonies was a space of 4 feet, 8.5 inches between the tracks. And I always say we have to use the imperial measures in this case because that's what those groups were using at the time. And 4 feet, 8.5 inches to me has always just been such a random sounding number, right? Like it just kind of comes out of the blue. But there is a logical explanation for that number. And the fact is that when these groups were sort of planning out the Canadian rail system, we were a colony of the British Empire. And so the easiest thing to do was to say, hey, what do the British do? We'll just kind of borrow the model that they have in place. And as it turns out, the British had built their railroad system with a gauge of 4 feet, 8.5 inches. So I guess that makes sense that we would adopt the same thing in Canada. But it does sort of raise the question of how on earth the British ended up with a structure that has such a random number attached to it. And part of the story is that as we go back in English and British manufacturing history, we find out that the first trains were built by companies that had previously built trolleys or streetcars. And when it came time to kind of transition from streetcar making to train making, they didn't want to tear down the factories or uproot the assembly lines that had been doing that. So they wanted to keep the same systems and structures in place. And it turned out that trolleys and streetcars had been for decades and decades built with wheels that ran on tracks at the gauge of 4 feet, 8.5 inches. So of course, to shift from trolley making to train making, it made sense to kind of stick with that basis and kind of keep going. It does raise the question, though, of why on earth British trolleys were built with wheels that were 4 feet, 8.5 inches apart to run on tracks with that kind of a gauge. And if we go further, a little further back in English manufacturing history, we find out that the very first trolleys or streetcars were built by what were known as wainwrights or wagon makers. And it turns out that these wainwrights for centuries had been building carts with wheels that were about 4 feet, 8.5 inches apart. And so, those early decisions to shift from wagon making to trolley making meant they didn't want to throw all their tools away. They wanted to keep the kind of same tools that they'd had, the same work that they were familiar with. And so it made sense that when you built those first trolleys, you lined them up with the wheels on your wagons, and you stuck to that 4 foot, 8.5 inch metric. But that, of course, raises the question of why on earth British wagons were built with wheels that were 4 feet, 8.5 inches apart. And the answer to that, of course, is that they were designed to run on British roads. And over centuries of use, British roads had ruts or grooves worn into the roads that were 4 feet, 8.5 inches apart. Then part of what you wanted to do if you had a wagon and you were, taking your farm produce to the local market or something, was you wanted your wheels to kind of fit into those ruts and grooves because it gave you a much smoother ride. If you were outside those ruts, you'd be kind of bouncing all over the place. You might lose part of your load. You never know. So there's this sense that you wanted to fit into those grooves. And so to do that, your wagon needed to have wheels that were 4 feet, 8.5 inches apart. Well, I guess that makes sense as well, but that begs the question of why on earth these ruts and grooves were 4 feet, 8.5 inches apart. And the answer to that particular question comes from the fact that the British road system was first laid out and laid down by the Romans when Britain was a colony of the Roman Empire. And it turns out that the chariots that the Romans rode up and down those roads had wheels that were 4 feet, 8.5 inches apart. So that's where those ruts and grooves first emerged, kind of 2,000 years ago. And I would say the reason that Roman chariots had wheels that were 4 feet, 8.5 inches apart was that that's the size of two Italian horses' arses. And so you gotta kind of construct your chariot to sort of fit with the horses that are pulling it. And I like the story as an illustration of where logical, effective decision making can go wrong. Because here we have a sort of a chain of events over the course of 2,000 years that leads, through a whole series of logical, responsible decisions. We don't want to throw away our tools. We don't want to change our factories. These logical decisions kind of lead us to a point in the 21st century where we have this mass transportation system in Canada whose base unit of measurement is Italian horses. And I think if we were to design a transportation system that met the needs of today, we'd probably choose some other unit of measurement. And so, as I say, there's lots of debate on this online and whether this each step of this this story is kind of 100% factual or true. The root message is true regardless, that the systems that we build over the course of history are not necessarily the ones that serve our communities best today. And so part of what we need to struggle with is to sort of say, as I make decisions about the future of my community, about the future of my economy, the future of the communities that we're trying to build, am I making decisions that are convenient because of, structures that have been put in place over the course of centuries? Or am I really thinking about what's going to kind of give us the best opportunity moving forward? And I think that's part of what we need to be bringing to this whole discussion around AI. Am I really just looking for widgets and tools that allow me to keep doing the same things that I've always done? Or are we really going through a fundamental transformation that suggests I need to use new tools? I need to use new base units of measurement and new ways of thinking about what comes next.
Wonderful. You do such an incredible explanation of that. And I really hope that a lot of folks tune in and listen to that. And especially in government, to be quite candid. You mentioned logical, effective decision making. I think that is such an important thing that needs to happen at all levels of government. And that idea, as you mentioned, it's regardless of the story, it's that is reality. If you ask so many people, even at a family setting, hey, mom, like, well, why do you cook it this way? oh, well, my mom cooked it this way, or simple things like that. But it's, is it the best way to do some of these things? In some cases, like mom's cooking, absolutely, because it's delicious. But in some of these other areas, maybe not the case. So I think it's important to ask those questions and have those discussions and, take a step back and think about, why are we actually doing this, and is this the best possible way? But a whole lot to think about there. It's super interesting, and great advice for folks, which takes us into our next question a bit, Brock, which is advice for new economic developers, whether it's somebody starting their economic development journey, or folks who are a bit more experienced. What is a and I know there's a lot of advice there, but maybe start with, what do you think would be the key advice that you would give to yourself, if you could go back in time, and something as well that, would have a meaningful impact on somebody's community?
Yeah, that's I mean, that's such an easy question in some ways, but difficult in so many others, because there are so many potential pieces of advice. What would I offer up that I think might be genuinely useful? Maybe building on our previous discussion there, I think the first thing is to not be afraid to embrace new ideas and novel approaches, right? I think that good economic developers are curious. They have a kind of a voracious appetite for new ideas and new information. What is changing in the economy? What is changing in my community? What is changing in the way that business operates? And how do I kind of familiarize myself with that process of change, with new ideas, with new technologies, with new ways of thinking? And then try to work in a way that allows my community or my region to take advantage of that transformation, of that change. How do I avoid kind of, just doing the same things over and over again, or running the same kinds of programs we've always done and hoping that we get better results this time? So I think that sense of creativity and innovation needs to drive our economic development work. And it's a challenge for economic developers to constantly find ways to kind of bring that into their own thinking about the space. But I think the other thing that I would really strongly emphasize is this notion of, what is the role of an economic developer? And I think sometimes, I mean, this is a danger always at all levels of government or in the consulting space or in universities, that we become convinced of our own expertise and the power of our own knowledge, that we've studied this, we've worked on this for X number of years, we're embedded in this space, so we have the answers. I think the best economic developers are not experts who tell people what to do, but are, I don't know, are servants, are facilitators, who find a way to unlock the strengths and opportunities that exist inside their community. And so really that put their community forward as the real source of knowledge, the real source of expertise. What is it that the community desires to be or to become? I think there's a role for leadership. The community doesn't always have a clear sense of where it wants to go or what those future opportunities are or what comes next. But I think that one of the things economic developers will always benefit from is embedding the community and its voice and its sense of leadership as central to the economic development direction. There's all kinds of amazing things that we can do in economic development, but what does the community want us to be doing? And to really kind of understand what that is that they want us to be doing, we need to be engaged with them. We need to be asking them what it is. We need to be letting them lead the economic development process to some extent. So that's the business community, that's the taxpayers in a community, that's the people who make up the social fabric of a community. That really economic development is about meeting their needs and their objectives, rather than us kind of coming in as experts with all the answers and telling them what they need or telling them what they should do. And so that kind of sense of service, I think, really needs to underpin economic development. I always sort of, as I reflect on this practically in the context of my own career, I sort of think back to different jobs that I've had. And I worked for the city of St. Catharines down in the Niagara region, and I can remember sort of, showing up day one and kind of reviewing my my mandate letter? What's my official job? And when it boiled down to the basics, I was supposed to generate new tax revenue for the city of St. Catharines. That's not really why I'm passionate about economic development, right? It's not the tax revenue. And certainly we want businesses to do well in our communities. We want the economy to function well. But again, if I think about St. Catharines, what's the biggest private sector employer? Well, historically, it's been General Motors. I don't get out of bed in the morning as an economic developer because I want to help General Motors make a larger profit this year, right? It's not irrelevant, but it's not what motivates me to do this kind of work. And I think for most economic developers, when you come right down to the basics, when you ask that fundamental question of why do we want to do this stuff, it's because we understand that there are things happening in our community where we can be part of unlocking the potential of the community. There are individuals who have an entrepreneurial vision and just need a little bit of help to get there. There are people who just want to get a good job and support their family. There's the parent who just wants to make enough to be able to send their daughter off to college, right? There are these individual dreams and visions of what success looks like. And part of what we need to do as economic developers is to support those individual dreams and visions. That's why we come to this space, I think. That's why most of us end up staying, why we love this space, because we can genuinely help people accomplish those visions. And we don't do that through, tax generation or through corporate profits. I mean, that's not irrelevant to these questions, but it's not the primary motivation for what brings us here. So if we understand that our motivation is about those individual visions, then I think it kind of colors the way that we approach our communities and the people that we work with in those communities, and it really helps us kind of understand a different kind of role for the economic developer.
Unlocking potential. I think that is that's such a strong thing. And I know I took this course with Matthew McConaughey of all people that he offered it. And one of his lessons of many that were in there, and he was to ask yourself that question of why. And his thing was, you got to ask yourself seven times because you need to really find out why you're doing something. And I think you hit the nail on the head with that is unlocking a community's potential and people's potential. Because there's a lot of folks, as you said, that are just on the cusp and they just need that a little bit of support or direction to really make an impact on their own lives, but also on other people's lives, and through that a big impact on their community. And I know during economic development and working with government, there's always, challenges, but there's also opportunity. So I was just curious if you had any thoughts on, are there certain types of challenges you faced in the past? Do you think that some of these challenges are maybe, opportunities for the future?
Yeah, I often reflect back on my first real economic development role, which was back in rural Nova Scotia. And this is sort of early mid 1990s. I'm really showing my age here now, but as I went back, this is Digby and Annapolis counties in the southwest part of Nova Scotia. This was a pretty terrible time for the economy of that region. Canada as a whole was sort of coming out of a recession. But the economy of that particular region was being hit by a whole series of crises. So, one of the largest employers in the region had been the Department of National Defense, and they closed the naval base in the community there. The largest industry in the community was the fishery, and there was a moratorium on a number of elements of the fishery and real challenges in terms of the viability of other elements as we sort of thought about whether or not fishing would survive as an industry on the East Coast. Even some of the basic things like the physical links to other parts of the country, that region relies on a ferry link between Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, and the government was no longer prepared to kind of subsidize that ferry. We had to go through a privatization process. This whole question of whether or not it would be possible to find a private operator for the ferry. And so I came into a community that at that point was very depressed, both economically and kind of socially, really kind of feeling like there were no opportunities, that this was the end, that things were over, that it was going to be pretty difficult for anybody to make a go of living in that region, given all the things that were happening and all the ways in which the economy was headed. And so I think that one of the things that did for me was kind of convinced me that, you never let a good crisis go to waste, which I think is something valuable for Canada in 2025 as well. But this sense that, part of what makes economic development work is not just, business operations and tax flows and economic structures and these sorts of things, but it's about a community's sense of what it can and can't do. And I arrived in a community that believed it could not do anything. And I think that to me, that's become one of the biggest things about understanding how economic development works when it's at its most effective. It's taking communities to a place where they do believe that good things can happen, where they do believe that new opportunities will emerge, and that they are prepared to themselves invest time and money and effort into making those things happen. And so economic development is not just about sort of business patterns, but it is about the kind of the social cohesiveness and motivation of communities as a whole. And that's really tough to change and to challenge and to reshape. But I do think, that it can be done, in that particular set of communities. We basically rolled up the sleeves and started over. We rethought the way that the fisheries could work by focusing on inshore fishing rather than sort of factory fishing. We retooled the forest industry and the agricultural sector in those spaces. We rebuilt that abandoned military base for other purposes. We rethought how entrepreneurship could be a driver of what was going on at the local level. We embraced sustainability and ecotourism and green energy generation as drivers of the local economy. And as we started to do all of these things, the skepticism initially was almost overwhelming. But after a few successes, people began to see the potential to really transform the community. And so the energy changed, the perspective changed. People began to understand the way in which economic development, when it's embraced by an entire community, can actually transform that community. Now, I often think that that's easier to do in rural places than it is in sort of larger urban centers. Partly, you've got less people that you have to convince. But there's this sense that, even in the most marginalized, remote, out-of-the-way places, that it's possible, if you can overcome that sense of negativity and that sense of doom, to do very creative and very positive things. And I spent 4 years in the community. The Royal Bank called our forestry work the best economic development practice in Canada. The World Bank was promoting our sustainability work in China. The United Nations was talking to fisheries dependent communities across the North Atlantic about what we'd done as a model of how to kind of revitalize fishing communities. There's this sense that, even in a reasonably short period of time, that shift from this will never happen to we can do this created a bit of a model that many communities started to learn from. And I have this sense that biggest challenge for economic developers is often getting the community on board with where these things can go, building that sense of belief and that sort of can do, hoist ourselves up by our own bootstraps kind of an attitude. But if we can accomplish that, then I think there's really no limit to what the economic developer can
Absolutely. We can do it.
do.
And folks listening, you can do it. You can make these things possible. I think that's such a wonderful way to begin our close off, Brock. And first of all, I just wanted to thank you so much for your time today. I really genuinely appreciate you taking the time. You've done so many things, talked to so many people, and been around the world, and you're taking the time to sit down with me today and chat about economic development. I just wanted to say I really appreciate that.
Oh, Mason, you're very welcome. I always love to chat about this kind of stuff, and I'm really excited about the podcast that you're launching and the things you're going to be able to do in terms of taking these economic development messages out to a much broader audience. So happy to be a part of the beginning of something great.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I know something I wanted to tie into the interviews as I go on is an end question. And so essentially what I'm doing with each guest is they're providing a question that won't be released until the next interview. So feel free to, spend some time thinking about a question for whoever I'm going to be interviewing next, because you won't know who it is. But I will ask that question to them. And I do have one that I asked a friend for. I said, hey, I'm talking to somebody and we're having a really interesting conversation about economic development. If there's one question you could ask them, what would you ask? And they provided me with a really, timely question. And I think with the discussion that we had today, something that's really relative. They said, with everything going on in the world right now, if you had to start your career over and wanted to become an economic development officer, what area would you focus on and why would you focus on it?
Oh wow, that's a tough one. I what would I start with? I think I kind of reflect back on my days in university where I studied a whole bunch of really useless things. I shouldn't say useless, but fun things that I enjoyed. I was doing a master's degree in African history for a while, for example. And I think if I knew that I was going to be working on economic issues as much as I have been over the course of my career, I might have chosen a little bit of formal learning that helped me out a little bit more than some of the things that I did get into. But I think that one of the realities that I've learned is that economic developers are jacks of all trade, that we are people who kind of have insights or work to build insights into a whole series of aspects of how local communities and local economies function. And as a result, I'm not sure there'd be a lot over the course of my career that I would fundamentally change or kind of go back and say, I wish I'd done that bit differently, because the varied experiences and the varied kind of opportunities along the road are part of what I think have made me a better economic developer. There's lots of things I don't know, but I've benefited from the range of things that I have seen and have been a part of over time in a way that I think has probably made me a more holistic economic developer. And so I hope we don't get to the day where you can do an undergraduate degree in economic development and this becomes a kind of a career path that you can just opt for. I hope that we continue to be this kind of strange mix of people from 100 different fields coming together because we have a passion for building local economies and local communities. And I always hear people say, well, can you come to economic development from any space? And I'm reminded of a student I once had whose background, academic background, was in fashion. And they're a great economic developer out in Alberta. I won't name them, I don't want to embarrass them. But we come to this place because we have a belief in what we can do. And the skills and ideas and knowledge we bring from our experiences are what allows us to kind of drive that forward. And so I'm not sure we should second guess ourselves to say, I wish I'd done this differently, or I wish I knew more about that. But embrace the fact that we do come from such diverse backgrounds, and that as a community, we can collectively do some pretty amazing things.
I love that, embracing the differences. I think that is so key. And also, I'm sure if I asked my wife if I was involved with the strange mix of people, she would definitely say yes. So, but honestly, I think it's what makes you unique and what you bring to the table. Because if you have these different life experiences, I know you mentioned studying African history and such, and I'm sure from that, there's things that you can pull in your daily life and when you're chatting with people and just having an understanding of things a little bit differently than somebody else might have. So I think it's okay to be unique, and I think being unique is a strong point when it comes to economic development. And I just wanted to thank you so much, Brock, for taking the time to chat with us today. And thank you for being unique and for being Brock.
Thanks, Mason. I appreciate the chance to be with you.
Hey, you. Yes, you. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to today's episode. When I'm out and about, whether I'm, biking or walking or driving, I love listening to podcasts. So it really is special to me that you took the time to tune into Hyperlocal today and listen to our podcast. I want to make sure we're able to give you the best content possible in the future, get the speakers you want, talk about the topics you want, and really make a difference in your community. We want to focus on those little things. And a big thing to help us do that would be if you could take this opportunity to make sure that you're following the channel. If you want, feel free to turn on the notifications and we can make sure you get notified on the next episode. And I just wanted to say thank you so much for caring about economic development and caring about your community. And keep up the good work. You're not alone out there.